I guess we're ready to begin. First, I'll make introductions. My name is David Carrier. I'm at the Manned Spacecraft Center here in Houston. Sitting next to me is Dr. William Quade, who's from the Ames Research Center, also NASA facility. Dr. Michael Dentz from the Dominion Observatory, Ottawa, Canada. Professor von Engelhardt from the University of Tübingen in Germany. And the subject of the panel discussion today is shock effects and soil mechanics. I'm here representing miscellaneous or soil mechanics. Before I just sum up very briefly on that, I would just like to say I find it ironic that in this, the last and probably the most important panel conference of this meeting, that I, as a civil engineer, am moderating it. I guess my long hair was a disguise sufficient to be a scientist. Let me go into very briefly then the significance that has come out of this meeting in regard to soil mechanics. The first thing that is very important to me is that the unmanned surveyor spacecraft gave us very good predictions of what it would be like for the first men to walk on the moon, to work on the moon, to sample, and the landing effects on the limb, and so on. It was a very well-designed spacecraft, and it performed very well. More specifically, the mechanical parameters that we use in our calculations, such as bulk density, shear strength, friction angle, and cohesion, adhesive properties, were all predicted in advance by Surveyor. And we were not particularly surprised by any of the occurrences. Now, getting to the LRL results, the specific gravity of 3.1 was very interesting to us in that it is significantly higher than the specific gravity of of average terrestrial soils, which is about 2.7. The fact that that value was less than the specific gravity of the rocks was the first indication that the soils are not just ground-up rocks, so we're very pleased about that. The grain size distribution, we knew at the time in the LRL that we were probably missing the smaller sizes of material, but from what has been presented so far, we didn't miss that much. The bulk density, as shown in the core tubes, unfortunately, was the design of the core tube bit was such that we could get a value anywhere from 0.7 grams per cc to 1.7 grams per cc. So we couldn't say anything too definitively from that. The Apollo 12 mission, we can, but I won't bring that up here. Finally, and very significantly to me at least, is the fact that the soil has been found to be very non-homogeneous. And going back a few years ago, I can remember how we would have to battle the homogeneous moon people, who I hope have been put to rest. Particularly the core tubes revealed very complex mode of placement of the soil, and I'm sure that we'll learn much more about that.
I guess I'm supposed to summarize my feelings about the entire meeting, and since I am basically a field geologist, I feel I've learned a great many things, and some of them in particular that have interested me are the problems with the determination of the ages of the rocks, and this has bothered me. And let me say, at the first part of the meetings, I was very badly bothered by the apparent age of the soil. And I say this because models that we had derived on impact studies of deriving the regolith indicated to us that the regolith should reflect the composition of the rocks in the immediate vicinity of where it sampled. That is to say, if this regolith is formed by impact craters. 95% of the ejecta of an impact crater is deposited within a few crater radii. And no matter how many times you impact it, the randomness of the process is such that it will move the material back and forth, but it will not homogenize it. And so when Professor Weatherall was saying that he expected that the surface materials were represented a very homogenized lunar surface material to give this apparent age of 4.6 billion years, this disturbed me because I don't think we'll find the material to be this homogenized. I expect that in Apollo 12 site, the regolith there will reflect basically the composition beneath it. I also think that we have to be very careful about discussing the material sent from the highlands to this area. It's certainly true that material sampled anywhere on the moon can come from a crater anywhere on the moon. But the materials have to be in very small numbers. Likewise, the meteoritic contribution to the lunar surface is another problem. One can make some calculations. I've never done this for the contribution of meteoritic material, but one can visualize it in the fashion that a meteorite excavates somewhere from 10 to the third to 10 to the fourth times its mass. That is, the amount of material thrown out by one meteorite is 10 to the third, at least 10 to the third times the amount of that meteorite in mass. This says that from one crater, you should have less than a tenth of a percent meteoritic material. Well, if you repetitively bombard something, this will build up, and particularly if you repetitively bombard the surface material without penetrating into the harder rocks beneath, you will increase the contribution of meteoritic material, but one would expect in the neighborhood of 3 to 4% as a maximum, I feel, in this regard. I think most of the debris in these areas that we've seen samples from, that we've seen photographs of, have been produced locally, that they've been worked, and to a great extent by the finer materials, and particularly by the very small particles, which many of these small impact craters to me indicate, are probably cometary particles, particles with very high velocities. And these, when they hit, will certainly melt and to a great extent vaporize. Part of that material will be deposited within the regolith from a vapor state, and part of it will be mingled with the other. And I don't know how well we'll be able to segregate this out. But I still have a very difficult feeling about this average age of the regolith. I don't think we can add enough extraterrestrial material or enough material from the highland to work out what is an average age, and I think the answer must lay somewhere else. I was Bill Quaid from the Ames Research Center.
Michael Dennis from the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa. I think that probably Professor von Engelhardt will want to comment about some aspects of the mineralogy of the shock phenomena. I think we must be impressed by the fact that we've had a very wide range of petrographic experience applied to these rocks and soils. People who have looked at them with spectacles of all colors, and while the group who are here perhaps have had a bias in terms of looking at and for shock metamorphism, and there could be a claim made that we do have a special bias in this way, I would say that the large number of other investigators who have had no particular experience or in this field, and but on the other hand probably have a very large experience in volcanology and petrology generally, the fact then that these people have come up with no example whatsoever of any suggestion of volcanism other than the initial formation of these crystalline rocks is a very significant result of the whole thing. In other words, we do seem to see evidence for volcanic activity or igneous activity, melting of a large part, if not the whole moon, very early in its history, and essentially no evidence at this site of subsequent volcanism. On the other hand, we do have the hints that the same processes of impact which are going on locally in the Mare Tranquillitatis area and have contributed, I think, to the very large proportion of the impact phenomena that we have seen. We have the hints from a few of these unusual rock types that the same sort of process is going on in the uplands area, and that we're getting a few small pieces, much of it in a highly deformed condition, coming from craters in that area. Perhaps I could address myself to another question which came up quite early in this conference, and this observation is based on my experience from studying craters on Earth, which we believe on the same basis of shock metamorphism are due to impact. This is to the question of the flux. There does seem to be a problem, which probably Bill Quaid will have something to say about, perhaps, of understanding the crater counts in terms of the very old ages that have been seen. And the explanation that Dr. Shoemaker seemed to subscribe to was that this was, we do seem to have a very high flux at the present time. He suggests that this is much higher than has been in the geological past. Now, the craters that we have examined on Earth and which we feel are probably the result of impact here are a number in the 50 or 60 altogether for the Earth as a whole, of which more than half are known from North America. These are rather small statistics, but they do seem to point in a very definite direction. With one or two exceptions of very large, very old craters, which are of the order of 2 billion years old and are only known from their deep roots, all of these craters are of the order of 500 million years old or less. Now, we do seem to have distribution here. The crater size, I should say, ranges from a mile or so across up to 40 miles. And so these are quite comparable to the lunar craters, and it's quite obvious that there are probably quite a number of smaller craters which are no longer preserved. Anyway, the point of this is that we now have a fair handle on the ages of most of these structures by the same general methods that have been applied to the moon lunar material, and we can say that there's been probably much more activity in terms of large-scale bombardments of the Earth in the period 500 to about 200 million years ago, with a peak around 200 or 250 and tailing off to some extent down to about 100 million years ago. And then there seems to be a great dearth, a great lack of craters until perhaps 20 or 30 million years ago, and the activity perhaps is picking up now. But in terms of the overall activity in that 500 million year period, I would say that the present activity is perhaps average, or perhaps even a little less than average. If there has been less, apparently, in the past, but that we've also had periods of apparently considerably greater activity. It's very interesting that this 200 million year age has been given, at least by Professor Hartmann, to the very large crater Tycho, which is the largest fresh crater on the near side of the moon. Maybe.
I may perhaps say first a few words about the indications which you have for the action of shock waves in the lunar regolith. These are first shock damaged mineral grains, which range from certain deformation structures, which we know from experiments and also from terrestrial craters, until the destruction of the crustal lattice through shock waves, and then we have molten material, which we think is produced by intense shock waves. Now, all our conclusions come from terrestrial experiences and from experiments with shock waves. We find in the lunar regolith relatively few of these shock-damaged mineral grains. And this is the first surprise we were involved with the investigation of the shock rocks of terrestrial craters. We expect to find much more of these characteristic shock deformation structures. But we have found a great many mineral particles which have lost their crystal structure, mainly of plagioclase. And this is a very characteristic and undoubtedly an effect which undoubtedly is due to shocks. Shock waves, which we knew, must be higher than, must have peak pressures higher than about 300 kilobars. And then we have all these molten materials, all these glass fragments and small glass spherules, which amount to, to a high percentage of the gunnerite. If all this molten material is due to shock, then we can say that the largest part of the regolith has been produced by shock. I would think that it's a general agreement, nearly general agreement, that these glass particles are due to shock, are produced by shock melting, not by an organic activity of any kind. The reason is that each particular small granule, spherule or fragment has another chemical composition which can be understood as a particular mixture of the rock-forming minerals of the lunar rocks, plagioclase and pyroxene and ilmenite. This is quite different as was one finds in terrestrial pyroclastic rocks, where the particles, the small small glass particles, have almost the same composition. But in this case, each small spherule has been formed by a shock-induced melting of a small part of rock, which is composed in a certain percentage of the minerals. So I would say that all these glasses demonstrate the activity, the importance of shock events of impact. Now it would be very interesting if it would be possible to measure the ages, not of the whole thing, but of these individual globules, because each of them represents a single impact event. And the whole question of the age would be would become really interesting if one could resolve this average age into the different ages, individual ages, from which it is composed. And I'm sure that the whole spectrum of ages will come out, if this is possible, but I'm not sure about how, what is the smallest grain on which an age determination could be made. I don't know.
I just have to say for the tapes that was Professor von Engelhardt. We can either, well, why don't we do it simultaneously, throw it open to the press as well as any technical people here interested who want to argue with us or agree with us or anything.
Questions? The gentleman back here.
Arnold, I wanted to come back to something Mr. Quaid said at the beginning about the fraction of the material which can be extraterrestrial. I think many of us have gone through similar estimates, and I think it's rather gratifying to note that one discovers, this has been reported by many of the mineralogy people, a fraction of a percent of high nickel metal, which is rather plausibly identified as meteoritic, and which if multiplied by some factor for the amount of stony material would put one observationally in just about the ballpark that you suggest.
I've been increasingly worried, and I wondered if Dr. Quaid could say anything about the problem. The fines appear to be saturated, or at least, if not saturated, fairly heavily loaded with solar wind. Now, the range of these particles in the solar wind material must be very small, hundredths of millimeter or something. Yet here there appears to be a regolith of some considerable depth, surely a meter and a half and maybe more, which is saturated. How can it be that this thing can all get turned over enough in geologic time that we have left to get it all saturated at such a thin, light, slow rate?
I'm not sure I can answer this completely, but there is a turnover rate of this, and of course there's an accumulation rate. In my model, to begin with, this material starts with a hard rock surface, and as it's bombarded with meteoritic material, the surface of the regolith grows with time, and so this material is at the surface at each incremental period of time, and at the same time, it's being stirred, and it's being stirred to different depths as a function of time at different rates. The very near surface is apparently being stirred, to a depth of a centimeter in what? I don't know exactly what the rates are, but I think people who are working with some of the rare gases and fission track ages can estimate better than I can what the rate of turnover is. But I think
it's saying millimeter, 1,000 years, a million years. I mean, and this is getting awfully small.
I think it's more than millimeter per million years. It may be 10 centimeters per million years, something in that order, but I can't define it. I don't have any real basis for defining it. But the thing has been turned over repetitively, just literally hundreds and thousands of times. And different particles have been at the surface at different periods of time, and different sides have been up, different sides have been down. But I can't really put any measures on it. The people who are working with fission track can do much better than I can.
But you think you still feel there is enough time to saturate this material or cover it, at least the density it is, for many meters of it in 4.5 billion years.
Yes, I think this is very adequate.
This is for whoever on the panel wants to do some speculation. Going back to the first panel discussion on Monday, Dr. Gold mentioned that we find no signs on the surface of trenches or pile-up at rocks that have been ejected. Would any of you like to speculate on just what this mechanism may be that is smoothing out the lunar soil?
Well, maybe.
I think it's just the mechanism I'm talking about. We're talking about a surface which has accumulated a thickness of only about 4 meters of debris over approximately 4 billion years, and this isn't a very great rate. And I don't think you can expect to create a surface, a groove in the surface, and have it last any great period of time. I'm sure the astronauts' tracks will last for a very long time, but compared to geologic time, they will be smoothed out and they will no longer be observable. An impact crater, the same way. You can study photographs of the moon and recognize ages of craters where they're degraded with time. The rims disappear first, and gradually they're filled in. This is just a process which goes on all the time on the lunar surface, and these features are destroyed just by, I believe, repetitive impact, and primarily by the very small particles from which you've seen so much evidence at this meeting.
I'd just like to add a comment there. I'm not sure it's appropriate, but with the Apollo 12 mission, one of the photos revealed what some of us call the famous Valentine crater, which was a small crater a couple feet across, which was quite heart-shaped. And at the time, it was tentatively identified as the result of a secondary impact, that is, a low-velocity impact or a groove, just what you're speaking about.
May I make a comment? If Tommy looked at some of the very large supply pictures that we have,
such grooves and pile-ups of material are relatively common around very fresh, blocky craters. One can see where blocks have come out and bounced half a dozen times before ending up with a pile of material on the downrange side. But I think that Quaid's comment is appropriate, that is that the fine-grained material gets stirred up so much by the very fine rain of small hypervelocity particles coming in. Since we see these down to the smallest possible size, it does get smoothed over. But the fillets that were observed first in Surveyor and then on 11 and 12 indicate the movement of material selectively. And on the sides of craters, the uphill side has material piled up and the downhill side does not. So we think we see the process going on. And most of the rocks have been there long enough so that the evidences for their originally landing there are now wiped out.
Other questions or comments?
I think the younger age of the rocks on the surface might be, relative to the apparent age of the finer material, might be in the direction of supporting possible volcanism over a longer time period than one would perhaps be led just by Apollo 11, because Apollo 12 indicates a much more recent age of the rocks. And from all the features you can see on the dark areas of the moon, it's strongly suggestive that a lot of material could be thrown out over long periods of time, geological time, and this material would be volcanic bombs and blocks to produce secondary impact craters.
No comment.
Brickstell, Washington State University. I'd just like to make one comment. It has surprised me a little, the concern over the apparent discrepancy between the so-called age of the soil and the ages determined for the rocks. The regolith is obviously made up of particles of rocks which have been disintegrating mechanically. They've been transported. In that sense, they are sediments, and they are comprised of particles of older material. Therefore, an age determination for a rock fragment in the regolith is an age determination for the time at which that rock fragment crystallized and is in no way an age determination for the age of the soil. It says nothing about the time at which that portion of the regolith was deposited. The question instead, I think, is where are the older rocks from which that particle was derived? And with the size of the sample that we have, I think it's not at all surprising that we haven't seen that particular rock in bedrock form yet.
Yes, this is what I was speaking to as I was saying that the processes in our model, we don't know how we can account for movement over great distances of that amount of material required to raise this so-called average age. This was the problem that was bothering me, unless there are very nearby materials of much more ancient age.
One of the mechanisms for stirring up the rocks is the infall of the meteorites, and micrometeorites, would one expect to find a size distribution which is different between the two and get some idea of what the mixing rate is from this difference in size distribution?
I don't think this is a possibility. Most of the small particles, when they strike, are vaporized or melted, and I don't think we can arrive at any kind of rate of this, if I understand your question correctly. Perhaps I don't, if there's any other comment here.
I didn't hear another comment.
Dr. Quaid, to go back to what you and Dr. Brickstell were just discussing, would this be an indication in your mind, at least, that the rock called Looney Rock 1, the rock that dated to about 4.4 billion years, would be a piece of this older material that apparently wasn't brought back in any quantity, rather than, say, a Highlands rock, as was suggested?
All I can say is it's a possibility, but I don't think it's too great a likelihood, because there are not more of us there. But I can't say yes or no. It's just a possibility.
Well, given what you said about the very short distances that you feel material is transported, do you think it's likely that it's a Howland's rock?
Oh, yes, this is a distinct possibility. I'm just saying that things can be deposited and transferred clear around the moon, but I just say the percentage of the material transferred from the highlands there is small relative to the locally derived material.
Any further questions or comments? If not, I turn it over to the moderator for his option.
I have to get home and buy some bread and milk.
Thank you.